From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the Patriot Act was first signed into law in October 2001, certain parts had sunset provisions. In other words, expiration dates. Three sections of the act are supposedly headed into the sunset in December, and this week Congress opened a discussion about whether to let them lapse. The president wants them renewed, and so, discussion notwithstanding, they probably will be. Some civil libertarians say the first three expiring provisions aren't all that important anyway. There haven't been many complaints about them. Instead, activists want to use the coming months to argue that another part of the Patriot Act, the part involving national security letters, ought to be reformed. National security letters give the FBI the power to obtain records from companies such as banks or internet service providers about their customers. And when a company receives a national security letter, it cannot tell anyone but its own lawyers. Greg Nogheim is the senior counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. He says that a debate on national security letters is far more important than arguments over the sunsetting provisions of the Patriot Act.
National security letters don't sunset, but there's strong evidence that they've been abused. The Department of Justice's own Inspector General issued two reports showing, for example, national security letters were issued for investigations that hadn't even been opened. Well, you can't get a national security letter unless you're conducting an investigation, and yet the government issued these letters anyway.
I understand more than 200,000 of them were presented by FBI agents since 9/11. Is that right? 200,000?
Yes. It used to be that you couldn't issue one of these letters unless you could show that the records pertain to a person who is tied to a foreign terrorist or to another agent of a foreign power. Most Americans aren't that. So the government could not use that power to get records about Americans. Patriot Act took that requirement away and said that you can get a national security letter whenever the information you seek is relevant to an investigation. Well, that opened the floodgates. Now, most national security letters seek information about Americans. And the Inspector General found that now many national security letters seek information about people two or three steps removed from the actual target of the investigation. The FBI is looking into information about me, but it says that information about you, because we've had contact, is relevant to that investigation of me. And then it says information about someone you've had contact with is also relevant.
What I'm having trouble understanding is why the expiration of the three provisions that not all that many people have a quarrel with is occasion to review the question of national security letters, the authorization for which is not expiring in December.
One of the provisions that expires, Section 215, the so-called library records provision, is closely related to national security letters. Both enable the government to get business records. Section 215 is broader but requires a court order. National security letters are for a narrower class of records, including email to-from information, of numbers you dial on a telephone. Now, Congress is taking the occasion of the expiration of Section 215 to examine national security letters, which apply to another class of business records.
It's not hard to understand why the Bush administration would acquiesce to the wholesale use of this kind of investigative tool. It's a little harder to understand why the allegedly transparency-friendly Obama administration would stand by the abusive use of national security letters. What has the Obama administration had to say about this? Why aren't they all over this?
So far, they've said nothing. The Obama administration has only said that it favors reauthorization of the three expiring provisions and that it would consider amendments to those provisions.
When a law like this is in place, you kind of have to trust the Justice Department and the FBI not to overreach. Do we have any data to suggest that we can trust Attorney General Eric Holder and the FBI under Obama than we could trust Attorney General Gonzalez and the FBI under George Bush?
The degree of trust that anyone has in any particular administration ought not to drive what's in the law. The question is, what will Congress do, knowing that it can't know who will be in the White House 10 years, 20 years from now when this power is still being used.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Greg Nogheim is senior counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. More disheartening news came this week from those who tracked the Obama administration's commitment to press freedom. The New York Times reported that the White House engaged in some behind-the-scenes maneuvering to gut a proposed federal SHIELD law that's been gathering steam in the Senate. SHIELD laws, on the books in most states, protect reporters from being forced to reveal their sources. A national SHIELD law has never made it through Congress, but in recent weeks it looked like the legislation finally had a chance. That is, until Wednesday, when the New York Times reported on the administration's proposed changes to the bill. Specifically, the White House is concerned that a SHIELD law would impinge on its ability to track down leakers, and it wants judges to give the administration the benefit of the doubt about what exactly constitutes a threat to national security. That's kicked the bill further down the road, some speculate, forever.
Also on Wednesday, a New York judge ruled against the American Civil Liberties Union in their lawsuit to obtain roughly 580 documents about the CIA's interrogation tactics, including memos concerning now-destroyed videotapes depicting possible illegal practices. This isn't the first time the ACLU has been party to a case like this. Since September 11th, it's successfully forced thousands of pages of formally classified documents about interrogations, secret prisons, and rendition policies into the public's eye. But the public can sometimes find the mountain of data, documents, interviews, press accounts, and books about what some call enhanced interrogation, but most call torture, simply overwhelming. Enter the ACLU's new project, the Torture Report, an attempt to synthesize all of that information into a simple narrative. Part advocacy, part storytelling, it aims to make America's interrogation policies post-September 11th accessible. Larry Seams is the principal author of the Torture Report. He started scaling that mountain himself 6 weeks ago, and what he found surprised him. Seams hopes that despite the intimidating volume of information, he can persuade the public to join him.
I think people should care about it. I think people do care about it. I think deep down, most people are troubled by the little bits and pieces that they've heard. And now the problem is that there's just simply so much evidence out there and so much material that, you know, that it requires an enormous investment to sift through it.
So you want that part of the brain that contains the conscience to light up?
Yeah, I think so. Or let's say mine has lit up.
And when you began working on this 6 weeks ago, you confronted a massive amount of information about the Bush administration's policies, also some about the new Obama administration's policies. You started sifting through it. What was the first thing you did?
The first thing I did was I started randomly typing in dates into the Freedom of Information Act document database that the ACLU has, just to see what would come up.
You threw some darts at a dartboard.
Exactly. You know, I would type in November 2001. And you would get maybe 100 documents. I'll give you an example. I pulled up a handwritten sworn statement by an interpreter in Kandahar Detention Facility in Afghanistan. She says, "I am writing this in response to events that I witnessed while performing my duties as an interrogator. So-and-so and I were conducting an interrogation on 3 January 2002. I took a break to regroup and check our notes. While we were out of the booth, several Special Forces members entered the booth. So-and-so and I finished our break, and we went back to continue the interrogation. When we entered the booth, we found the Special Forces members all crouched around the prisoner. They were blowing cigarette smoke in his face. The prisoner was visibly shaken and crying. So-and-so immediately told them to get out and not to come back anywhere near anyone that we were talking to. The prisoner was extremely upset. He said that they had hit him, told him that he was going to die, blew smoke in his face, and had shocked him with some kind of device." And she ends by saying, "I was very upset that such a thing could happen. I take my jobs and my responsibilities as an interrogator and as a human being very seriously. I understood the importance of the Geneva Conventions and what it represents. And if I don't honor it, what right do I have to expect any other military to do so?" Now, that was written a month before President Bush signed his order stating that the Geneva Conventions will not apply to al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners. One of my big jobs in this is try to keep moving back into these mountains of documents and find things like this, where you have the big story as it's played out on the ground level. there are an abundance of characters who exhibit extraordinary courage and conscience all along the way in this story, more than we ever knew.
That was the biggest news flash for you, wasn't it? That these policies were contested every step of the way within the chain of command.
Absolutely. And I think that's the question for all of us is what would we have done in her situation? That's our way into the story, you know?
So you've only written the first chapter, but mm-hmm. you decided to begin the story on September 17th, 2001. That was 6 days after the attacks of 9/11. How come?
Well, on September 17th, then President Bush signed a secret directive that would authorize the CIA to set up secret interrogation facilities. And in doing so, he'd created a space for torture to happen. Secret prisons are absolutely illegal because they're breeding grounds for abuse. At the same time, Congress passed the authorization for the use of force in Afghanistan, but Congress balked at giving the Bush administration some extraordinary powers that it was seeking, including the power to use the military on U.S. territory. And immediately, the administration lawyers sat down and wrote a memorandum in which they said the president can use the military in the United States. And so those two things, you have the secretiveness, including the creation of secret sites, which put, you know, literally people off of the legal map. And then you have the contempt for the law.
So how's it going? Is it what you expected it to be?
It's more enthralling than I expected it to be, I have to say. And the information is more varied and more surprising. It's more inspiring than I thought, in the sense that there are so many people who looked at the same set of facts about the threats that we face and never moved in this direction. And when others moved in this direction, they objected. I think we as a country owe it to those people to look at the whole story and to honor what they've done.
Larry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Larry Seams is the Director of International Programs at the Penn American Center and principal author of the ACLU's Torture Report. We'll link to his report from our site on themedia.org.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey pod people, this is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This year, Italy slipped farther in the global rankings of press freedom assigned by the Washington-based Freedom House advocacy group. Now it stands in 73rd place, reclassified as only partly free. In recent weeks, a petition protesting government control of the media has garnered 450,000 signatures, and Rome is the scene of a protest march this weekend, the target of which is Italy's media mogul prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi. But as Megan Williams reports from Rome, even critics say it's too easy to blame it all on him.
The launch of this fall's TV season in Italy got off to a dramatic start. After months of newspaper reports that he'd slept with prostitutes and partied with young women, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi took center stage on his favorite state-run TV show, Porta Porta, and let the press have it.
Quindi questa accusa è un'accusa infondata, comica.
He lambasted journalists, calling them scoundrels. He said the accusations of misconduct against him were unfounded, and that the idea that freedom of the press is in danger in Italy was international left-wing libel against the nation. What he didn't explain was why several other primetime political shows that might have competed for viewership with that TV appearance were postponed or canceled. After all, he controls all of public television and most of private TV, where 80% of Italians get their news. This is an old concern, but what's new is the brazenness of Berlusconi's attacks on the media. While Berlusconi passed a law giving himself immunity from prosecution, he's launched a volley of court cases. One case aimed at La Repubblica newspaper is not for what's been written, but for 10 pointed questions the paper keeps asking the leader. Berlusconi's family-owned paper has also gone on the attack, outing as gay the editor of a Catholic newspaper critical of the leader's behavior. And Berlusconi has urged advertisers not to buy space in papers critical of him.
No other European country, and certainly not the United States public opinion, would tolerate the repetition of violations that Berlusconi as a prime minister and Berlusconi as the owner of his own television and press exercise practically every day, openly.
Furio Colombo is a longtime Italian journalist who's taught at Columbia University. Recently, he and others founded a new Italian newspaper called Il Fatto Quotidiano, The Daily Fact, to provide unbiased criticism of Italian politics. Colombo says what's lacking in Italy is not just freedom of the press, but something even more necessary for democracy.
Public opinion. Public opinion means a natural independent attitude by the people to stand in front of you and demand why that news was not published, why that commentary was so particularly bended one way or another.
Berlusconi has filled the silence with self-aggrandizing statements that are never backed up, says Colombo.
He keeps going around saying, I am the best prime minister of Italy, and then he adds to this modest statement, I am the best in the world. And of course, these are strange statements that can be done only in a strange country that has no more freedom of press.
But despite critics, almost half of Italians are attracted by Berlusconi's bravado. Italy, after all, is the birthplace of melodrama, and many see his style as confident, that of a winner. Take this song, for example. Part of a campaign to get Berlusconi awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. It's one of several composed by adoring supporters who played at political rallies and on TV shows. There's a president who's always present, the words go. We're here for you, heart and spirit, one voice, Silvio, Silvio the Great. This kind of cult of personality approach by both supporters and Berlusconi himself triggers constant comparisons to Mussolini. But Italian political history professor Giovanni Orsina says that it's not just dictators who are oversensitive to the press. Democratic leaders whose popularity comes from their charisma show the same tendency. They interpret any criticism as a personal attack. But Orsina says freedom of the press isn't his biggest concern about Italy.
This doesn't mean that there are no problems. Of course, there is an imbalance, absolutely. But, I mean, if you want to have the views of the opposition parties on television, you get that. The main problem is that the opposition parties is so unsuccessful in articulating a clear view and even in deciding who's the person who's going to go there and articulate their view. And that, of course, in this moment is a major problem. Right now, there's no alternative. Berlusconi right now is the Italian political system.
And with a weak and fractured opposition, Berlusconi keeps on his rampage against the press. This week, his government launched an inquiry into a political talk show that interviewed the prostitute he allegedly slept with. In an interview, he again accused his critics of slander and called the freedom of speech march this weekend a joke. But many Italians feel like Berlusconi is the joke, a bad one, on them. The clownish billionaire with his outrageous gaffes, who nobody took seriously at first. But as critics head to the streets, few are laughing now. For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
This week, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood held a two-day summit on the dangers of distracted driving. Thursday, he announced that all federal employees will be forbidden to text while driving. The fact is, we've known about the dangers for a while now. Studies have shown that talking on the phone while driving, whether you're holding the phone to your ear or not, is just as dangerous as driving drunk. Texting and emailing is even more dangerous, but only 18 states plus the District of Columbia have banned texting while driving, and only 7 plus D.C. banned talking on handheld phones. The summit this week offers some hope that lawmakers are actually getting serious about the problem. But why now? Matt Richtel, who has reported on distracted driving for the New York Times, points to a recent American Automobile Association study that found that more than 35% of drivers believe the roads are more dangerous today than they were 5 years ago.
The reason I think that number is so compelling is, in the last 5 years, more anti-lock brakes, more airbags, more hundreds of millions, if not billions, to make roads safer, and yet people are finding the roads less safe.
And yet, it isn't that easy for legislatures to pass anti-texting laws. Why is that?
It's not easy for us to disconnect from our devices. This is both texting and talking while behind the wheel. You have folks who feel a sense of urgency to respond immediately to bosses, friends, social pressure, business pressure, so they don't want to disconnect from their devices. And legislators feel that populist message, and they also often are talking on the phone themselves a lot.
And what about the telecom industry? They are not necessarily the biggest fans of regulation. How much of a factor has their lobbying been?
I think their lobbying in places has been very potent. The biggest window into this, arguably, is the state of California, where from 2001 to 2005, heavy lobbying by the cell phone industry effectively killed legislation that would have required Californians to use headsets while they talk in cars. That bill eventually passed, but the way the senator who proposed that bill and pushed for it explained it to me, the industry lobbied very hard and made all kinds of claims, even to the point of saying that if there was a law forcing people to wear headsets, it would permit police to have an excuse to go after minority drivers who are not wearing headsets.
You mean they played the race card in an anti-cell phone debate?
They played the race card, yes. But things have changed for the industry. The Cell Phone Industry Association in January said that it no longer opposes such legislation. Here's what the skeptics will say. The economics have changed for the cell phone industry. At one time, every minute that someone was on the road and paying for cell phone service was really important to the bottom line of the cell phone companies. Now we pay for our minutes in big buckets. So, you know, I don't know, did the cell phone industry say we're worried about safety? Did their economics change? I don't know. I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that completely.
Yeah, so I have myself screamed at other drivers saying, why don't you just get off the damn phone, because they've done something reckless or inattentive. It hasn't altered my own car phone behavior. I'm still a kind of repeat offender. There's something about an incoming email that is irresistible. Are there any explanations for human behavior along these lines?
On the psychological end, there's something called intermittent reinforcement, and that's this idea that if you put a rat in a device where a food pellet only comes out of a hole periodically, the rat's going to be checking that hole all the time because it never knows when that food is available. Similarly, with our email and phone, most of the stuff we get is plainly unimportant. I think we could probably all stipulate to that, but occasionally something really important comes along. So what does that do? It randomly reinforces us to be checking all the time. But there's also a physiological piece that I find extremely interesting, and that says that when you check your device, you basically get the equivalent of a dopamine squirt. Well, if you get that little candy when you check your email and you check your phone, in its absence, you start to feel bored. So la-di-da, you're driving down the road and you're just doing this kind of task that seems rote. You start to feel that itch. You start to feel that boredom. Suddenly, you want a dopamine squirt. You send a text, which basically sets you up to get a response, which enables you to then send a response, or you make a phone call.
Is this a not-in-my-backyard kind of phenomenon? I want everybody else to get off their cell phone, but I don't want them to take away mine.
There's no question that's the case. And you look at the polls and, you know, something like 90% of drivers at once say, I'm a great driver. And some large portion of those folks regularly talk on the phone while driving or text while driving, and also say this is tantamount to drunk driving when someone else does it.
Yeah, well, that's because those other jerks, you know, can't drive while using their phones. You know, I can.
I know you can. You actually, it turns out we've done research and you're the guy.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt Richtel covers technology and telecommunications for the New York Times.
The old saying, freedom of the press belongs to the person who owns one, has been adjusted in recent years to reflect the digital age and the fact that, at least theoretically, nearly everyone does own the equivalent of a printing press. Here's former FCC Chairman Michael Powell in 2002 using the accessibility of the internet to justify looser regulation of the broadcast media.
Information technology also has this democratizing effect for consumers. With a low-cost computer and an internet connection, everyone has a chance to get the skinny, to get the real deal, to see the wizard behind the curtain.
The U.S. Supreme Court even chimed in a 1997 decision. Justice John Paul Stevens wrote, quote, "Through the use of chat rooms, any person with a phone line can become a town crier with a voice that resonates farther than it could from any soapbox." But there's a significant difference between speaking and being heard. So says Matthew Hindman, author of the book The Myth of Digital Democracy. Hindman argues against the conventional wisdom that says the internet gives any Jane Doe an avenue into the public sphere.
It may seem like that's the case, but if we look at the top 30 blog sites, for example, they're dominated by those who have advanced degrees from elite educational institutions, even more so than was true a decade ago. So if we compare, for example, opinion journalism, if we compare op-ed columnists to the top bloggers, only about a third of op-ed columnists have an advanced degree, whereas 75% of the top 30 bloggers have an advanced degree.
You make this sound like a bad thing. It strikes me that what you're saying is that a meritocracy has been set up online, not that necessarily having an advanced degree makes you meritorious, but the fact is that perhaps better communicators gather larger audiences.
In many ways, I think that it's true that we have a more meritocratic public sphere. I think that the blogosphere in general and online media more broadly do a great job of finding expertise. But at the same time, that's not necessarily good news for folks who take their lunch pails to work and still want to be heard in public debates.
You didn't see that much of Joe Lunchpail on the CBS News.
No, that's certainly true. But one of the things that has happened in online news and in online political commentary is that there was a period in 2004, 2005, and earlier where the sphere was relatively open. I think the concern moving forward is that there's a lot of evidence that that window has closed. Certainly the assumption, which you heard very often in the 90s and even today, that the internet is going to give voice to people who are voiceless. I think you have to believe that that's false.
You talk a lot about the gatekeepers of information in your book. Could you explain what you mean when you say that the infrastructure of the internet shifts the bar from the production to the filtering of political information?
There are basically two ways that people can find online content. They can either follow links from sites that they already know, or they can go to a search engine and type in a keyword or two, and it's the most heavily linked sites that are going to receive most of the traffic and most of the attention. Overall, what this leads to is a winners-take-all phenomenon, where sites that already get a lot of attention continue to get a lot of attention. And if you look at the patterns of links over time, they've become more and more concentrated on the top sites as the ecosystem as a whole has solidified.
You cited a study that found that the internet increased the knowledge of those who are already engaged in politics, but it had the opposite effect on people who were already apathetic.
What seems to be happening, if we look at the survey data, the people who are already interested and already engaged in politics, they know a lot more and they're able to consume far more political content than even existed a decade or a decade and a half ago. At the same time, if what you really want to do online is to hang out on Facebook or email your friends, there's a lot of people who choose to disengage completely. So before, in the broadcast era, we had lots of Americans knew pretty much exactly the same thing about politics.
And now when people are left more to their own devices, you can lead them to water, but you can't get them to drink.
The internet allows people to be far better citizens and far worse citizens if they want to be.
That's freedom, right?
Yes, but it's not always good for democracy. And I think we should be very careful when bright, smart, articulate, highly educated people talk about how the internet is empowering quote-unquote ordinary citizens. An awful lot of the time, what they mean by quote-unquote ordinary citizens is people who look an awful lot like them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be a perfect representation of the public.
And that's what we need the internet to be.
It's very easy for this somewhat insular group and socially quite homogenous group to miss things that are relatively important to millions of other Americans. On the left, for example, I think you find less pro-union sentiment and certainly less sentiment by union activists. It certainly receives less attention online than it does in other parts of our public sphere. On the right, I think it's pretty clear that religious conservatives, even though they do have important online niches, overall they get less attention than they do in other media and probably less attention than they deserve as a portion of the population as a whole. I think that if you compare the public as a whole to the views that get expressed most prominently in the blogosphere, I think it's a distorted picture. I think it is important to try and find mechanisms to make sure that the voices of ordinary citizens have at least some role in shaping a public agenda and some role in public debates.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Matthew Hinman is an assistant professor of political science at Arizona State University and author of the book, The Myth of Digital Democracy.
Coming up, how movie companies can peer into our brains and a TV show that once blew our minds.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Hollywood is breaking new ground in commercial penetration by experimenting with technology that can determine with scientific certainty what will make us scream. A company called MindSign is pioneering a technique dubbed neurocinema, which uses a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, or fMRI, to penetrate our skulls for a precise picture of what we're feeling when we're watching a film. Philip Carlson is co-founder of the company, based in San Diego. He is not a scientist. He's a film school graduate. He used to work at DreamWorks, where people in the marketing department would often complain about the emotion tracking tools currently at their disposal.
They use the focus group system, which we all know is flawed. And when you have a focus group, you've got about 100 people who come in and watch a movie. And then a couple hours later, they're asked to go over what parts were their favorite and what parts were they emotionally engaged in, how did they feel about a certain character. And not only can they not remember, but the majority of people cannot describe how they felt.
Describe the test you did using Popskull, which is a horror movie that came out a couple of years ago.
The producer of Popskull, Peter Katz, wanted to find the scariest parts of his movie. We had a female, 23, lying down on her back, and there's what we call a head coil that is clamped over her face. And this head coil has a mirror on it, kind of like a periscope, so that they can actually see the screen that is projected behind them. And I show her two scenes. One is a guy hears a noise in his house, and as he starts to go up the stairs, he sees a hand creeping around the corner and an intimidating, scary figure start to appear.
What did you think of this scene? Did you think it was scary? Be honest.
No. The second scene I found more disturbing, and my amygdala will back me up on that. A crazy maniac knocks on somebody's door, and the owner of the home opens up.
Hello.
And the next thing you know, he's getting a knife stabbed right into his chest. And as he pulls out the knife, you've got all the blood coming out and strobe light effects going on.
What was going on with the blood in her brain at that moment?
Well, the amygdala, which is the center of the brain for all your primal emotions, fear being one of those, it's calling in more blood to that area of the brain. There are also other areas of the brain that deal with personal meaning, emotional engagement, if they're even paying attention.
How do you see this technology being used on, say, a movie set?
Ideally, a director could send dailies out to us, and we can scan the dailies. For those of you who don't know, dailies are all the shots at the end of the day. They've got 7 shots that look exactly the same, but we can give you the most activating shot of these 7, and you can use those. You can actually make your movie more activating based on subjects' brains.
You know, some people say that we're already subject to too much crass manipulation in the movies, and that it's actually undermining the art. Do you feel any guilt about getting the art of grossing us out down to a science?
No, I don't feel guilty at all. Some people look at us as trying to steal art or basically revamp how they define art. And we're not trying to do that at all. We want to help make better movies all around. You know, when a studio is going to drop $350 million on the next Pirates movie, they better make sure that they're hitting on all cylinders.
What's the most negative reaction you've gotten to this whole thing?
There are people who say, you know, you can't make me like something or not like something. And, you know, we come back saying we're not trying to make you like anything. We're just finding out what you do like.
And then we'll make it.
Exactly.
Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Philip Carlson is a co-founder of MindSign Neuromarketing. Dr. David Hubbard is managing director at the Applied fMRI Institute in San Diego and the lead neurologist working on the NeuroCinema project. I asked him how closely these brain scans can really track our emotions.
The scan looks at the entire brain. Some of the brain is visual, some of the brain is auditory. One specific area is emotional processing. A different specific area is the sense of personal meaning. And then there's all sorts of other areas. There's motor areas. You can see whether someone is pretending to play tennis because the arm area is activated. But I still think that you can't necessarily know whether the person is feeling fear or disgust just because you've seen the amygdala activate.
But you might be able to tell if someone feels a personal identification?
Yes. There's a different area of the brain called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, right in the middle of the frontal lobe, that seems to activate when we are experiencing something that is personally meaningful.
What about sorrow?
Sorrow is different again. In general, sorrow will activate the amygdala. Once again, you can't just by looking at the amygdala know whether that person is feeling sorrow or anger, for instance.
But you can know if they're feeling love?
Compassion, empathy for others, happens to be another area of the brain. It's part of the problem is the meaning of the word emotion. So from a neurological point of view, emotion is more related to the visceral sensations of emotion, the actual perception of disgust or anger, whereas, for instance, love of country, that's not really an emotion. That's really a cognition.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you say love for another person, there can be the meaning of what that is as opposed to necessarily what visceral sensation the person is having at that time.
Well, let me ask you about a less abstract idea. How about lust? Does that light up a particular section of the brain?
Yes, that lights up the amygdala.
But we won't know whether someone is feeling fear, disgust, or lust.
Just by looking at the scan. If you don't know what the experiment was, what the stimulus was, just seeing the amygdala light up, all you would know is they're increasing their emotional processing. You wouldn't know what specific emotion they were feeling.
Dr. Hubbard, thank you very much.
Okay.
Dr. David Hubbard is managing director of the Applied fMRI Institute in San Diego and the lead neurologist working on the NeuroCinema project. Years ago this past Friday, a TV program debuted that became a milestone and template for many that followed. Here, courtesy of YouTube, is its creator pitching to prospective sponsors.
How do you do? You gentlemen, of course, know how to push a product. That essentially is your job. My presence here is for much the same purpose, simply to push a product. To acquaint you with an entertainment product which we hope and which we rather expect will make your product pushing that much easier. What you're about to see, gentlemen, is a series called The Twilight Zone. We think it's a rather special kind of series. Essentially, people watch television to get entertained. And the keynote of this series, the thing we're concerned with, the thing we're aiming for, the thing we're working toward, is entertainment.
We think Rod Serling doth protest too much. He wanted to entertain us, sure. Good science fiction plays out all sorts of possible futures, puts people in impossible situations, and flips realities like a deck of cards. But great science fiction does more than that. It doesn't just blow your mind, it opens it. And that's what Rod Serling's Twilight Zone did exactly 50 years ago Friday. There was usually a message to the zone's madness. Larry Kasson is the founder of the Rod Serling Video Festival and director of special projects at the Rod Serling School of Fine Arts in Serling's native Binghamton, New York.
To this day, he holds the record for more Emmy Awards for creative dramatic writing for television than anyone in history. His big breakthrough was Patterns, a wonderful story about corporate greed.
Now, it may be a rotten thing to lick a man's boots, but it's a lot worse to be the man whose boots have to be licked.
I'm not a nice human being. What else?
You're not a human being, period. You're a freak. You're an organizational marvel with no compassion for human weakness.
He followed that almost the next year with what I think is one of the best television teleplays ever written, Requiem for a Heavyweight, an indictment of the fighting industry.
What are you talking about, win the match? It's a setup. One night you win, the next night the other guy wins.
Depends on who plays the heavy.
Yeah, but I never took a dive for anybody.
The CBS chair, William S. Paley, when that aired, called the control room and said, tonight television was put forward 10 years.
He tried a few times to get his teleplay about the murder of Emmett Till produced. Till was the black 14-year-old who was murdered in Mississippi in 1955 after he allegedly whistled at a white woman.
Yes, he was terribly affected by the murder of Emmett Till. He did two scripts. They were totally butchered. They had to move it from the South to New England, and then eventually it became a whole different story in a small Mexican border town in the West.
Was it this incident that drove him into the Twilight Zone?
Well, yes, I believe he was so frustrated with corporate interference, and one of his famous quotes is that he could have Martians say what he couldn't have Republicans or Democrats say.
So give me some examples of what Martians or their equivalents could say that he couldn't say.
Well, for example, in the classic The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, he talks about mob violence. The Martians were invading, but they didn't have to lift a finger because the inhabitants of these communities fought themselves.
You know why I shot him? How was I supposed to know he wasn't a monster or something? He was only trying to protect my home and know it was somebody we knew.
What were the sorts of tricks and techniques Serling reached for to provoke emotion from the viewer?
Well, there were a lot of images of surrealism, mirrors, broken glass. He always talked about parallel universes. There were always these twists and turns. And one of the more famous ones was Time Enough at Last. There was an explosion, and a henpecked husband had a chance to read all the books he ever wanted. And then at the end, his glasses are broken.
That's not fair. That's not fair.
The small man in the glasses who wanted nothing but time. Henry Bemis, now just a part of a smashed landscape. Just a piece of the rubble. Just a fragment of what man has deeded to himself in the Twilight Zone.
What do you think his legacy is?
You know, of all his accolades, his Hugo Awards, the Emmy Awards, his daughter found out recently that our fifth graders in our local city here in Binghamton are learning to be better people by his words.
How?
We have a curriculum based on his scripts of The Twilight Zone where fifth graders will watch the episodes and read from the scripts and really work with their teachers on these deep social and moral issues.
Wow. Hey, Larry, can you do an imitation?
Oh, dear. Of Rod Serling, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try one. You ready?
All right.
You unlock this door with a key to imagination.
Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Larry Kasson is the founder of the Rod Serling Video Festival and the director of special projects at the Rod Serling School of the Arts in Binghamton, New York. They're celebrating the 50th anniversary of The Twilight Zone all this weekend. Another of Serling's legacies, how he paved the way for some of the famous names of the future. He gave Robert Redford and Charles Bronson their first jobs and influenced countless others. He died on June 28, 1975, the day after J.J. Abrams' 9th birthday. As a grown-up, Abrams has had a blazing career as a Hollywood writer, producer, and director, most notably of the TV series Lost and Fringe, both with explicit science fiction elements. He also directed the latest Star Trek film, and he says he stands humbly before Serling's artistry and vision. We caught him on his cell phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Talk to me about your relationship with Rod Serling. When did you first encounter him, and how would you summarize his impact on you?
I was a kid, and growing up in Los Angeles, The Twilight Zone was on twice a day on Channel 5. So it was an hour of the greatest TV ever. I literally would stay home from school and pretend I was sick sometimes to watch.
Was there a favorite episode, one that sticks in your mind?
The one that is my absolute favorite is called Walking Distance. A man in his late 30s, and he's in a suit, and he's a miserable guy, sort of miserable businessman. He's just unhappy, and his car breaks down.
Martin Sloan, age 36, occupation, vice president, ad agency, in charge of media. This is not just a Sunday drive for Martin Sloan. Somewhere up the road, he's looking for sanity. And somewhere up the road, he'll find something else.
And he realizes that his car is broken down very close to where he grew up. He, while his car is being repaired, walks back to this town. He realizes he didn't just walk back to where he grew up, but he walked back to when he grew up. And he's desperate to talk to himself as a boy. And in fact, he goes to his home. Of course, he's older than his parents. And they freak out. They don't believe he's really who he says he is. And he's talked to them. And he ends up dropping his wallet as he leaves. And later, he finds himself as a young boy carving his name into the carousel in town. And he goes after himself. And the kid falls down, hurts his leg. The adult falls down, hurts his leg. And there's this great moment when the man is sitting on this bench and his father comes back to return the wallet. And he says, I believe you are who you say you are. The license expires in decades from now. And I don't know how it's true, but you've gotten here. And the father basically says to him, you have to leave. And the man says, I just want to tell myself. I just want to tell him that it all goes away. The childhood, the carousel, the happiness, youth, it goes away. And I just want to tell myself. And the man says,
you have to leave here. I see that now, but I don't understand. We only get one chance. Maybe there's only one summer to every customer. That little boy, the one I know, the one who belongs here, this is his summer, just as it was yours once. Don't make him share it.
As you look back on your body of work, which do you think seems to follow most closely the pattern, the template set by Rod Serling? I think it might be Fringe.
The Twilight Zone is something that is so good. The work that Serling did set the standard, and so I could never and would never presume to try and sort of play in that playground, but I do think that Fringe, it exists in a world that certainly appreciates The Twilight Zone.
So when you think about what was most original about him or where he made his greatest contribution, do you think it was his moral vision or simply his script-writing technique? Because not every episode had a moral.
I think that it's a combination of his awareness of the underdog, his appreciation of those in pain, his empathy for those left behind. He was often the voice of those who didn't really have anyone else speaking for them. And he was able to combine that kind of humanity with an amazing ability to twist a story and be a magician, really, and have you look in this hand when, you know, the coin is really over here. And he was just the master of the left and right side of the brain, if you will, you know, the manipulation of structure and story, but the absolute emotion and depth of character. And for me, that's the thing that I always aspire to and don't ever think I will achieve at the level he did.
It strikes me that in The Twilight Zone, the material world was a very elastic place, and the only reality was inside one's own head.
He would allow every aspect of every story to be a potential variable. Nothing was off limits. And so when you watch an episode of The Twilight Zone, it really makes you wonder, in every mundane detail, is that what I think it is? He wouldn't just surprise you. He would really challenge the way you think. and make you reconsider who is us and who is them, and what is beautiful and what is ugly, and what our place is in the universe.
JJ, thank you very much.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
Writer, producer, director, JJ Abrams.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hover and Dan Mazzi, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katu Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Rod Serling, the creator of Twilight Zone, will tell you about next week's story after this word from our alternate sponsor.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.